Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver. This is the show that looks at business and politics from a wider perspective. And coming up on today's show, with news coming from Brussels about a change in emission targets, the petrol car may actually be here to stay. It was meant to be the mobile phone system that would change the world. So why is Skype closing down? And what is the dark enlightenment? And why is Elon Musk so enthralled with the idea? You can email us, of course, on takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, at the start of the year, new data was released by the Society of the Irish Motor Industry showing a significant fall in the number of electric vehicles sold in Ireland in 2024 compared to the previous year. Overall, but 17,500 new electric vehicles were registered in Ireland, but that represented a fall of almost 25% from the previous year. And then only this week, we're learning that Brussels will now ease new emissions rules for combustion engine cars, allowing the embattled auto industry to avoid fines following a slower than expected transition to electric vehicles. So the conventional wisdom, listeners, as you know, was that very quickly, I suppose, in comparative terms, electric vehicles would replace the combustion engine. But is that actually true? And are we going on a totally different trajectory, actually, when you go and investigate? So joining me now to discuss all of this is Philip Nolan, who's the motoring correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Philip.
Hello, Emmett.
Listen, thank you for joining us. As I said, we all were saying 2 or 3 years ago, gradually, bit by bit, we would see the petrol car go out and in would come the EV or hybrids. Obviously, there's two different types there. But that isn't quite the way it's going. It seems to be if the petrol car is going out, it's going out kind of slowly.
Yes, but it is, the market is very volatile. I mean, yes, the numbers were down significantly percentage-wise last year on the previous year. But last year still was the second best year for volume sales of EVs. And actually, so far this year, they've rebounded and, you know, EV sales are back up by 22.7%. So I think that for a lot of people are confused about when ICE cars, which is, you know, cars with internal combustion engines, when they'll be banned. And I think a lot of people maybe are thinking, well, look, I'll buy one more petrol or I'll buy one more diesel before I have to buy an EV. And, that, you know, price is an issue as well. So there's all sorts of things in the mix.
Yeah, and a lot of people have kind of argued about this carrot or stick. Is it, you know, the government did cut back some of the benefits to getting an EV. There's also people saying, you know, early adopters got the EVs and they're now up and running, but you're now hitting a wall where you've got maybe just the ordinary non-committed person who's maybe less convinced or could be more cash-strapped, which is probably a huge amount of people. So which one of those factors would you put your own finger on as possibly behind the trend?
I think a lot of people are just nervous about range. You know, it's the simplest thing about EVs that people are actually terrified of, that someday, you know, they'll be driving across the country and they won't be able to find a charger and they'll run out. And it's not like, you know, there's a petrol or a diesel pump everywhere in the country. There aren't chargers everywhere in the country. The infrastructure is not there yet by any stretch of the imagination. And also, it's, you know, it's very cheap to run an electric car if you're doing it at home on a night rate or if you have solar panels. But if you're doing it on public chargers, it's actually quite expensive. So I think the price of the cars, the, you know, unreliability of chargers, the lack of them in many places, and the price is just one of those things that all those things combined are what are putting people off, I think.
Now, in terms of the petrol cars themselves, as you say, the sales are still pretty strong. You know, you meet a lot of people around the place who are just going from one petrol or slash diesel car to another. So is there a group there that out there that, you know, they'll have it almost sort of pulled out of their hands, the steering wheel, no matter what any of the governments do, they'll stick with, you know, a combustion engine for however much they're allowed to do so?
Well, I think what we're really seeing in the market is the rise of the petrol electric hybrid, because like cars that run solely on petrol now are only 27%, 28% of the overall market. Whereas petrol electric hybrids are at almost 24%. So I think a lot of people are saying hybrid, whether it's just standard hybrid or plug-in, as a kind of a bridge between, you know, petrol-only driving and EV. Because for a lot of people in a hybrid, especially plug-in hybrids, pretty much all their local motoring is going to be fully electric.
Now, electric, car manufacturers themselves, I pay a bit of attention to what the CEOs say. And a lot of them, when you see them interviewed, they sort of say, oh, well, we thought we were going to dial down the combustion engine car a little bit quicker than we actually are, and we're actually putting fresh resources into that area. So these aren't stupid people. They put their money in the right areas. So they seem to be suggesting that the pace of this, we may have all misjudged this, that this is this transition is going to be a lot longer than we all thought about a year or two ago.
Yes, it is. I mean, like originally, I think most European countries had set a target of 2030 for the end of ICE car sales. That's now 2035 for the European Union. And so, you know, that's another thing that actually I think is putting off buyers is that they just don't know if it's going to be extended again, when the deadline, the real deadline actually will be. And yes, I mean, the car companies have dialed back. And even, you know, a company like Renault is now dialing back completely on plug-in hybrids. It's gone for hybrids only and for some electric models. But they reckon that the plug-in hybrid thing is kind of a waste of time. And the only car they're offering with plug-in now is the Rafale. So they've kind of turned their backs on plug-in hybrid completely.
Now, in terms of the second-hand market, that's, I suppose, one a lot of people were hoping that would take off and that would put a more price-conscious consumers into the mix. This is electric vehicle second-hand market. A lot of people say, well, you know, the battery could be in bad condition by the time you get the car, etc. So where are we in the second-hand EV market? Or is there much of a second-hand EV market?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I know a lot of people that are. I mean, obviously, the first generation of cars, like, you know, the Nissan Leaf, which had much smaller batteries, there probably wouldn't be a huge amount of demand for them. But certainly, there does seem to be a reasonably healthy secondhand market in EVs at the moment because there were such supply problems after the pandemic. But I don't know how long that will last. And also, you know, Tesla in particular at one point engaged in very aggressive discounting. And that kind of really annoyed people because if they'd only already paid full price for the car just like weeks or months previously, and then suddenly it was 5,000 euro cheaper, well, that's obviously 5,000 euro that's going to come off residual values as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's still a slightly untested market here because, again, the volume of sales really only took off in sort of 2019, just pre-pandemic. And so there aren't as many of them, obviously, available, either new or secondhand, as there would be of petrol or diesel cars. So it's a bit of a gamble, to be absolutely honest about it. But that said and done, I think that it will definitely grow. And also, the battery depletion thing is a bit of a red herring, insofar as most reliable surveys show that maybe battery depletion is 2% a year compounded. So even after like 7 or 8 years, you probably still will have well over 80% of battery capacity left.
Yeah, but do a lot of consumers know how to go off and test the whole thing out? Or, I mean, is that knowledge and can you trust what you're seeing in the indicator? I don't know, but is that
an issue? Again, you know, it's a relatively new technology in terms of mass market adoption. So people can only, I suppose, there are lots of surveys available online if you search for them. And there are lots of guides where people do, you know, tests of cars in real world driving conditions in winter, in summer. And they actually build up a database of what mileage, what range you can expect and what the battery depletion is. So these are, they're easily searchable and they are reputable people who conduct the surveys.
Now, I notice in China, they're talking about a completely different model, which is instead of charging up, you just whip out the battery entirely and replace it with another one. You go off and you drive away and you have it for a period and you go back in and they put it in again, another one. Is that ever going to happen here? Are we going to be, because you're saying charging network is poor. Is there an alternative route to go here?
No, there is. I mean, I've seen that where you drive in and the battery is just taken out and a new one is put in. But like, you'd have to question, you know, if we want to have 1 million EVs on the road here in 10 years time, you know, and let's say even 10,000 of those people want to charge every day, like storing 10,000 batteries in stations around the country is going to be difficult. And again, they have to be recharged as well. So I don't know how realistic it is for mass market adoption. And to be honest, you know, I think the figure is around 85%, I think, of people in Ireland who have EVs literally do all their charging at home. So I don't know if it's a huge, big deal for people.
Now, do we know anything about who has EVs? And what I mean by that is socially. So you know, obviously they're expensive cars. If you just take them in isolation, they're a big purchase price, certainly until recent years at least. So do we know, we talked about early adopters and so on. I've seen a lot of coverage about certain people who have them are more comfortable, middle-class purchase, all of this sort of stuff. Do you pay any heed to that? Is this a sort of a middle-class occupation of buying EV because that's simply what the purchase price brings about? Or do you see, no, it's more broad than that and I'm being desperately unfair?
I think it's probably fairly narrow, to be honest with you. And I say that absolutely purely anecdotally. But because I obviously drive a lot of EVs every year on test and I do have to charge them at public chargers, it's a community. You know, everybody wants to talk about your car. They want to find out how far you can get on a full charge. It's a kind of a social thing as well. It's a bit like after the smoking ban, you know, people started talking outside the pub and meeting strangers or whatever. And you do that at electric charging stations as well. And most of the people I meet, to be honest with you, are pretty much middle to later aged men like myself. That's
delicately handle that, Philip. Yeah.
Well, I am that age, but yeah, I mean, like, you know, yeah, I think as well there are a lot of people who genuinely buy EVs for environmental reasons, and they have that entire lifestyle, and fair play to them. But I would say that the vast majority really are probably on the older end of the scale, and in my experience, predominantly male drivers as well.
So you seem to be saying old middle class men are buying EVs. Is that?
Because they have to charge their pacemakers, they might as well change the car.
As the saying goes, you said that, not me. Now, listen, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is just where the winners are going to emerge. Obviously, you've got this BYD phenomenon. I saw their CEO commenting the other day about, you know, we're pushing ahead of Tesla, the on-driver technology they have is better and so on. And you expect that from different companies. But I do see a lot of taxi drivers around Dublin in particular in BYD. So who's going to be the winner out of all of this? You know, obviously Elon Musk has got his political problems and so on, but who's going to be coming through strongest, do you think, if you were to look into your crystal ball 2 or 3 years hence?
Well, the Chinese are obviously huge players in the market already. They've got BYD. We recently had the arrival of XPeng. You have MG. Polestar made in China. So, yeah, I mean, the Chinese EV influx into Ireland is colossal. BYD have sold more cars already this year than Tesla, but then the best-selling BYD model actually is a hybrid. So you can't take that too seriously. Tesla here, funnily enough, has had an increase in sales by about 30%. Compared to mainland Europe, where sales are down by as much as 75% in France. And, you know, people talk about the Musk effect, perhaps, but also the Model Y is their bestseller, and there's a new version of that due in the summer. So it could simply be that people are waiting rather than buying the outgoing version. But it's hard to tell. But definitely China has, you know, massive resources in this area. It has huge battery factories. A lot of the companies make their own batteries, like BYD. And the cars are just, like, you know, absolutely full of technology. They're incredibly comfortable. They're well built. And China will win out eventually.
So you don't put much store on these tariffs that have been slapped on their vehicles. You don't see that as putting a ceiling on.
No, I don't. And the funny thing is, actually, funny enough, European car makers were kind of pretty annoyed about that. They felt it was a bit of a solo run by the European Commission because they didn't want it. Because a lot of them are in partnership with Chinese companies for various elements. In fact, some of the cars are even made there, obviously. So, you know, that was a bit of a that fell fairly flat with the car makers. And also, even with tariffs, China can still undercut. Do you know, I mean, it's a huge.
Yeah, but I mean, are the European politicians going to be happy to see, you know, Volkswagen or whoever go to the wall in 5 years' time? So, you know what I mean? Like, there's going to be a cost here.
Yeah, but even the Volkswagen CEO didn't want the tariffs. You know, that's the whole point. They all want to be on a, you know, a level playing field. I mean, Volkswagen yesterday announced the new ID1, the ID1 Everyone, it's called. And, you know, in Germany anyway, that will come in 2027 at €20,000. So everybody is moving to make cars more suited to individual segments of the market. The problem for people buying electric cars is everybody buys the car with the biggest battery thinking that they need it. But in actual fact, if you analyze your daily commute, you probably don't need, you know, a 100 kilowatt battery. You need something that will do, let's say, 250 kilometers on a single charge, not 600.
No, we're a small place, you know. Well, like, exactly. A small island, we don't need it. Well, in fact, Ireland's probably the worst laboratory to test them out at all, isn't it? I mean, that's it.
It is. But you know, the other problem is, unfortunately, that for a lot of people who would actually buy that 20 grand ID one, everyone. that would be a city car. And yet, you know, you have people living in cities where apartment buildings don't have chargers. You have people living in the likes of Stonybatter, which you would think would be, you know, the ideal place for people to buy electric cars to, you know, play into the entire lifestyle. And yet they all live in terraced houses and they can't put chargers outside their houses.
Now,
people would have to go over the path.
Philip, people like me who are into all this sort of economic stuff, we talk about peak oil and when are we going to no longer use oil. So let's go and have a look at when is the last petrol car going to leave the Irish roads. Neither me nor you know the answer to that, but how many more decades will there be people driving around the streets of Ireland in a diesel or petrol car, do you think?
The understanding always was, but again, like, this is also up in the air, and this was an Eamon Ryan thing, if memory serves me correctly. The understanding was that sales in Ireland of internal combustion engine cars would end in 2030, which isn't going to happen. And that they would be eligible for MOTs, I was going to say for NCTs, up to 2045. So 2045 is the earliest date at which you will see the removal of all ICE cars from Irish roads. So we're looking at another 20 years at least, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're a mechanic at the moment listening in, good news, you've had a few more years left of work, because I know there's a whole industry around maintaining petrol cars because they need more work than EVs because there's much more components in them, right?
Absolutely, there are much more moving parts. And yeah, I mean, that in actual fact, an awful lot of the car companies now are trying to make as much money as they can off after sales, you know, things like servicing or whatever, because that is where the money is. And it won't be there forever, but it'll be there for 20 years.
Okay, well, listen, we'll do an interview in 2045 when we're both old and decrepit. Philip Nolan is the motoring correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail. Thank you for joining us here and taking stock.
Thanks, Emmett.
Now, this is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we make our final Skype call. Now, welcome back to Taking Stock. This is Emmett Oliver. Now, it may not be something younger listeners know anything about, but in the mid-2000s, it was the default internet-based phone video service of its time, connecting millions of people around the world for little or nothing. But it was announced this week that its parent company, Microsoft, is finally putting Skype out the pasture, and we're recording this call on the same platform and technology. So hopefully this is a bit of history being read right in front of you listeners. So joining me now to reflect on its impact and legacy is Chris Stokel-Walker, who is a information and technology journalist and a communication specialist in the areas of tech, AI and digital culture. Chris, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me, Emmett.
Now, Chris, we all have been on Skype. It's been the subject of hundreds, if not thousands, of family reunions. And, you know, everyone's parent has gone and talked to their migrant son or daughter in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, etc. on this technology. So why, with such buy-in over the years, is Microsoft saying goodbye?
I think it is just simply Microsoft being pretty brutal with their products. They have realized that there was an opportunity here for Skype to kind of go from one strength to another during the pandemic, at a time when we were all pushing ourselves online and looking for ways to communicate through those means. And Skype was meant to be the next big thing. But hovering on the horizon was an app called Zoom. And then we also adopted Microsoft Teams, which is obviously by the same company but a kind of competing service, and unfortunately those two won out. And so I think probably Microsoft is saying, well, you know what, it's been a decent run, first launched in 2003, so we've had 22 years of Skype now, but actually there are better products, we feel, at least, although there are many of us who use Skype and our adherence to it will mourn its loss.
Yeah, and I see that, you know, it's been a big platform. They actually bought it for $8.5 billion in cash, Microsoft, about 14 years ago. So that was a lot of money then. It's a lot of money now. So this wasn't a small sort of artisan business that they just snapped up and developed. This kind of came to them pretty fully formed. One of the reasons it had such stellar growth was the cost of it all was very low. This is at a time when people were probably more worried about the cost of texting and phone calls and so on. So do you think that's possibly a factor that simply, as the cost of other technologies has dropped, that sort of advantage that Skype had has kind of been whittled away?
Yeah, it's lost its head start, I think, against competitors. Although it is notable, I think, that there aren't actually other competitors that do exactly what Skype does. So, for instance, I like to use it as a journalist to call people in the United States, where lots of the people that I would interact with are not yet on WhatsApp. They don't really have a reliable phone service sometimes. And frankly, just the cost of international calls is so great that I tend to use a Skype subscription. You mentioned expats there, Emmett, in terms of, you know, many of us will have family members in Australia or elsewhere around the world that we want to keep in touch with. They may have WhatsApp, but actually a lot of them don't necessarily use that. And Skype is something a little bit more permanent. So it will be, I think, a big loss. But it is, I suppose, notable that actually all these other services have, as you say, come around. They've managed to kind of match Skype for what was at the time pretty revolutionary. We all remember 20 years ago, the cost of international calls and the fact that actually video calling itself wasn't really that popular. Skype was very much revolutionary in all of its time. It's just that
I can actually still remember the conversation when I first used it, and someone said, and you can see the person too.
Precisely. And that's the thing. This was a hugely transformative technology, and that is why Microsoft forked out the big bucks for it back in 2011. But then we've seen better organizations come about.
Yeah, and I'm looking at a number of possible assassins who've kind of taken it down. But is it Apple's FaceTime? Is that the critical one that was maybe the last straw?
I think that was a key one. I think that, you know, if you think of it in two buckets, Emmett, so we have the people who are using this on a desktop or a laptop or an iPad, they are more likely to be those who would use Skype for kind of long-form video conversations. In terms of those short international calls, either with a little bit of video or a little bit of audio, I think that FaceTime is a kind of killer app for that, as well as maybe WhatsApp for large parts of the world. Certainly, if you have an Apple iPhone, then you are likely to use FaceTime more than anything else. But of course, one of the things to bear in mind is actually the iPhone isn't the predominant model of phone elsewhere in the world, and frankly everywhere in the world. It is an Android phone, and I'm a person that has an Android phone, so I can't actually use FaceTime myself.
Yeah, I know. We those of us who have Apple phones, we just presume everyone else does, and then we get a terrible shock when they're on a Samsung, etc. So in terms of where this goes from here, can Microsoft excavate anything out of this, or is Skype just dead as a doornail, or is there something they can transition to? Obviously, they'll sweep some people towards Teams and so on, but is there a new product out there, or is it just, look, it's dead, done, over? What would Microsoft actually do with all this technology they've built up in Skype?
From our understanding, it's dead and done. They are willing to write the obituary of Skype, and instead they are saying, if you want to, you can move over to Teams. Now, that is useful for lots of the functionality that people might have used Skype for in terms of those video calls with people who have specific usernames, but it doesn't account for that key demographic that actually right now, Emmett, is completely disenfranchised, which is the idea of not using Skype as a kind of Skype to Skype connector, but using it as a Skype to phone connector. I genuinely have used Skype for, I think, the last 10 years of my professional career, buying subscriptions to call people in the United States, in Canada, in Ireland, in Australia, because it is cheaper than me doing it through my pay-as-you-go phone here in the UK, and also because it's just more convenient, because I know that I can find someone wherever they are in the world, wherever they are in their day, rather than relying on someone to be in front of a video screen, a video camera on Teams or on Skype at a prearranged time.
Yeah, and I mean, I've done Teams and I've done Zooms on a smartphone, and it's not good.
I mean, they are very clunky, aren't they? This is one of the things that I think we lose with this, which is Skype was a relatively lightweight app in many ways. It was quite simple to use, quite intuitive. It didn't have all of the bells and whistles, didn't really, I don't think anybody's ever used a text chat in Skype, whereas there is this kind of inherent belief whenever you use Teams or Zoom that you have to keep an eye on several things. The people in front of you in their video, the participants list, the chat, the buttons and reactions that are occurring, all of those things are quite difficult in a way where Skype was actually quite a clean interface.
Now, obviously, there's another phenomenon going on here, which is just we don't talk as much anymore. And what I mean by that is the rise of text, audio messages. People just generally don't do long conversations visually with other people. Obviously, they do it in a work context, but you do see that trend of a lot more alternatives to just communicating directly with another human being. So is that part of the story as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I regularly teach journalism students and have done for around about 7 or 8 years now. And every year I see students coming in, and every year I try and teach them that one key part of journalism, because frankly, one key part of human communication is that we talk with one another. We talk with one another live and interactively. And to do that as a journalist, you have to pick up the phone. And increasingly, I think there is an anxiety amongst younger generations of the uncertainty that can ensue when you are in a live conversation. I don't know what you're asking me next, Emmett. And while I have become used to that and had practice with that, younger generations that have been growing up on smartphones and interacting through text or asynchronous voice notes on WhatsApp rather than live chats with one another using voice, they become really anxious about that. So I think that that has had a key part to play as well, where actually just Microsoft is looking at the demographics coming around the corner and what they want from their interactions with one another and thinking, well, Skype doesn't really cut it.
Now, Microsoft, they don't back too many losers generally. You know, obviously they bought into LinkedIn, which has kind of worked out. All their cloud business has worked out. So, you know, they're not a company known for getting it wrong too often. I suppose having spent the $8.5 billion in cash, which for Microsoft is small beer, but not for the rest of us, it's funny to sort of see them almost, you know, kind of pulling away from this technology and admitting defeat. So it is rare enough for Microsoft, the big giant, to kind of say this one is kind of reached the end of the assembly line.
It is, and I think that is what is really notable about this decision. It is not just the personal stories of the people who are affected, but actually it is a kind of a closing of the door of one form of communication and one era of the internet. Maybe Microsoft is looking at this and thinking maybe it's not necessarily a failure, but they're thinking actually, you know, this was set up in 2003 at a time when our human interactions with one another on the internet were very different. And
we sort of live in the world of Zoom now, right? Don't we? I mean, I know there is Teams and there are probably one or two other platforms that I'm not aware of, but we live in a sort of Zoom land. So where are we going with Zoom? And what I reasonably ask you that is at the time of COVID, it did exceptionally well. The stock went up. Everyone seems to be kind of permanently wedded to a Zoom during 2020 and 2021. But it has come off since then. The stock has kind of been a bit neglected. I know they've added new features and tried to beef it up, but is Zoom necessarily the big winner from the demise of something like Skype, or is Zoom got its own problems? And some of the phenomenon you're talking about where we don't talk to each other, you know, could also start to bite into them as well.
Yeah, I think there is an element of Zoom fatigue going on where we've kind of come through the pandemic and we were used to having to be in front of camera all the time. Certainly, I certainly have people who I interact with who say, actually, I'd rather not have cameras on this time if that's okay. I'd rather just do a voice call. And I think maybe that is something to do with the sluggishness of Zoom's share price at the minute. But I do think that those kinds of communications tools are still the norm and have kind of stuck around in a way that perhaps I didn't expect. I thought we might revert back to kind of the traditional phone call or, God forbid, actually meeting face to face.
The landline is coming back, says Chris.
Indeed. But instead, I think actually what we've seen is that there's kind of been a reversion to the norm. And, I find it even just in terms of kind of interviews that I do as a journalist is that, you know, the default mode now is, oh, we'll send a Zoom link rather than a phone number, which is good in many ways because it means that you kind of have an element of privacy. That personal phone number that is yours is not available to all and sundry, but it can make it incredibly difficult because, for one thing, if someone doesn't turn up to a Zoom call, they might be busy, they might be stuck somewhere. You could traditionally phone them on their sort of mobile phone and that would be with them, whereas now you can't really get hold of them.
No, if you ring most companies and you ask for the person at the front desk, you know, you ring in, the receptionists are often kind of almost puzzled that you would try to access someone that way. You know, they just, if you're looking, they won't give you an email either. So it could be quite difficult to actually get somebody, which a lot of consumers are very upset about because they can't get to anyone anymore in a company where they have a complaint.
Yeah, and this is one of the ways that we are seeing, I think, sort of a level of hierarchy being introduced that refracts us away from direct communications with one another. And again, this is another hangover of the pandemic where companies recognize that actually they could maybe let customer service standards slip a little bit. They could try and put some distance between themselves and their customers. And actually, they've managed to kind of hold on to that. I think they are gripping tenuously to that as we try and fight back a little bit and say, well, hang on, things have changed. We're back to normal now. People are returning to the office. So should your phone lines.
Chris, somebody listening in, there are probably lots of them who have lots of contacts built up. They were real Skypers for many years. They've got all the names. They've given out different nicknames and icons for various people they've been in contact. Can they do anything with those, or is it just cut your losses now, or can you sort of turn them over into some new platform, Teams or otherwise? Well, what do you do if you were a very enthusiastic Skyper? Can you get any value out of the 40 or 50 contacts you have there?
You just move them over to Teams. So Microsoft is offering you the chance to export your Skype data, including all of your chats, your contacts, and your call history.
Right, so there's still some use in them, you know. I'd love to know what's going to happen to the brand. You know, I saw Enron coming back a few months ago, so maybe Skype can be reinvented, not as a telecommunications platform, maybe a fashion brand or a pair of jeans or something that can be used that way. Listen, we let it go. Chris, thank you very much for talking to us. This is the last bit of history. We don't have a drum roll. We have nothing lined up to mark this moment here, but thanks for your final ever Skype call. I'm sorry to see it go. Personally, the place where you could see someone on your screen, and we all were very excited, doesn't seem so novel anymore, but thank you very much. That's Chris Stokel-Walker, who is a journalist in the technology area and a communicator specialising in tech, AI and digital culture. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll be looking at the strange philosophy motivating Elon Musk. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Emmett Oliver. Now, every single day that something happens in the Trump administration, we try to put a rationalization around it, a philosophical box. There's obviously, we'd love to know what motivates or animates the Trump administration. Some say it's nationalism, some say it's protectionism, some say it's nativism, some say it's just Trumpism. So my next guest has a very interesting theory that may be something called the Dark Enlightenment that may be motivating both President Trump and those around him. And that guest is Rana Fruhar, who is a columnist with the Financial Times, and she joins me now. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Rana.
Hey, thank you so much.
It's great to have you. Now, we're all scratching our heads every day. Our jaws freshly hit the floor when we hear some of the things that are, I suppose, upending American politics and global politics at the moment. And we're all looking for that why or what's behind this, or, as I said in the intro, a philosophical box to make it all neat and tidy for us. And you've been writing about this idea of a dark enlightenment that might be motivating some of those, at least, around President Trump. Tell us more about this. It's not a concept many of us will have come across before.
No. Well, you know, it was new to me as well, but I was just sort of amazed, frankly, when Elon Musk went in and within days started dismantling the plumbing of the federal government in the U.S. And I thought, what the heck is going on here? Started reading about him, his background, and I came across this idea of dark enlightenment, also called the neo-reactionary movement. It's actually something that's been around for a while. It's very popular in Silicon Valley circles, but it's really the brainchild of a British philosopher, Nick Land, and a American software programmer, cum philosopher, Curtis Yarvin. And it's really the notion that, look, a democratic capitalism has failed us. Freedom is not compatible with democracy. We need a world without government. And in fact, in order to be truly free, what we really need is a king CEO that manages the oligarchs that have risen up in the last 20 years or so as wealth inequality has increased. And this is a philosophy that has been espoused by people like Elon Musk, by people like Peter Thiel, also, you know, a venture capitalist, a founder of Palantir, very involved in the Trump administration, sort of behind the scenes, and a lot of Silicon Valley folks. It kind of dovetails with a certain techno-optimism and libertarian feel that has always been present in Silicon Valley. And if you go back for 10, 15, 20 years, you can see many of these characters that I've just mentioned talking about this, writing about this. And I think this is really what makes Elon Musk tick.
And Rana, is this a sort of another version or allied to the whole tech bros idea? Is it somewhat similar?
Well, you know, tech bros is kind of a shorthand for these guys, and they're almost always guys in Silicon Valley that sort of think, hey, you know, I've risen up on my own steam. I've raised myself by my bootstraps. I'm the sort of great man. I mean, it's as if many of them have read a little bit too much Ayn Rand and been, you know, doing ketamine and playing video games at the same time. But, you know,
and we know they do some of those things, right?
They do all those things, actually. but you know, it's the notion that there is a sort of natural ruling class, which, by the way, dovetails with the sort of techno-fascism that you saw in, you know, in the 70s in South Africa. In the 30s, the Italian fascists were sort of techno-optimists and believed that there were, you know, great men that should really be ruling the rest of us. And it's this idea of hyper-meritocracy based, in this case, on IQ, really. And it is something that a lot of people in Silicon Valley will openly espouse.
So in other words, the idea that smart people should rule because they're smart, that's at least what they believe.
Right. That's right. And I think that also people like Elon Musk, ironically, given that he's been literally the biggest beneficiary of climate subsidies on the planet, government climate subsidies, you know, he thinks that he did it alone. You know, he's the guy. And this is something that is really ubiquitous, frankly, in America, but also particularly in the Valley, because it is so disconnected from the rest of the country and really the rest of the world in terms of how robust its economy is and how much wealth has been created there.
Now, you've got this obviously philosophical underpinning for this movement. Then along comes in 2016, a while ago now, but Donald Trump, New York property developer, real estate mogul. Is he just a convenient vehicle for these ideas, do you think? Or do you think any of them have permeated to him personally at all, or what?
Oh, no, I wouldn't actually give Donald Trump credit for an ideology. I think that, you know, if you look at what the dark enlightenment folks would espouse in terms of the idea of dismantling government, they first look for a puppet leader, which, you know, you can argue that Trump's in charge. You can also argue that his ego is in charge, and his ego is easily manipulated. I mean, I think that's one of the things that Elon Musk is doing right now by flattering the president, by, you know, kind of my hat is off to you and you're the man. You know, Trump looks at him and he really admires people like this who have tons of money or tons of power. I mean, look at the sorts of people he admires: Putin, Elon Musk. So he's motivated by power. He's motivated by commerce. And to the extent that someone can sort of take a person like that and manipulate their ego, then I think it's the perfect vehicle to then go through the next steps, which are literally, and this is like in writing, if you look at, you know, some of the things online about this philosophy, dismantle the plumbing of the government, watch as institutions fail, and there is a sense of cynicism developing around the rule of law, which is certainly the case in the U.S., and then watch as that cynicism turns into apathy or turns into a kind of a, you know, emotional discontent that becomes easier for, frankly, fascists to manipulate.
So is that their ultimate destination, to get to a form of autocracy, a tech-infused autocracy where, you know, popular voting franchises take it out completely? I mean, how far are these guys, or as you said, they're mostly guys, how far are they prepared to take this ideology from what you've read?
I think they would take it as far as they possibly could. And as evidence of that, I would look at some of the free trade zone sort of extra governmental states that these folks have funded. There's a place in South America called Prospera. It's a literally kind of a city state that was bought and funded by people like Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen, where there is a private army. There are no rules and regulations. You know, you can do whatever crazy biotech experiments you want. You know, these sorts of city states without government that are totally privatized have actually proliferated over the last 20 years or so. In fact, there's a wonderful book by a friend of mine, Quinn Slobodian, called Crack Up Capitalism.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, and I think he was commenting that Peter Thiel was going around the world trying to buy individual islands to try, sort of create his old new empire.
Yeah.
I mean, one part of me sort of thinks, okay, you know, these people obviously have these crackpot notions that most of us would dismiss, but yet they have the money and power to implement them, so they have to be taken seriously. Equally, you know, they're not the first sort of utopianists to go around the place. Are you kind of confident that they'll eventually overreach? Or do you actually say, no, this is an actual, real, tangible threat to the democratic system we know in the West, at least? Or do you say, look, these guys will eventually blow themselves out and another idea will come along?
I think we're on a knife's edge right now, honestly. You know, it's funny, I'm an economics and markets person, and I look at the markets and I see the markets, which, if you think about the markets as a kind of a proxy for the wisdom of crowds, I think people think it could go either way right now. Stocks are still relatively high, which would indicate that, you know, people think, well, this is a passing thing. We're eventually going to come back to the median and to some kind of normal. And then you look at the price of gold, which is always an indicator of massive geopolitical disruption, at record highs and going higher. And that says, no, we are at a pivot point. Things are going to fundamentally change. I can't predict what's going to happen, but I do try to explain to people in my columns and, you know, on programs like yours, what's happening so that they can be aware.
Yeah, and I suppose the enemy of these people would be greater government control or regulation in particular, and they've managed to strip away a lot of that in the last few weeks. Obviously, there are still some agencies there, but they've been neutered in many cases. I suppose the biggest obstacle for them, and this is just a personal thing, but the biggest obstacle for them is, can they export what, as you said, kind of originates in a Silicon Valley context? Can they export that elsewhere to other parts of the world. Is that...
Well, they have. They have. If you look at the way in which, you know, Elon Musk's, you know, X has been involved in election manipulation. If you look at... essentially, there are two choices technologically for people around the world right now. You can be part of the Chinese surveillance state and use that set of technology and platforms, or you can be part of big tech in America, which is its own kind of surveillance state. And we still, Europe is doing, the best job, but we still have not found a way to regulate these people, to get them to open up the black box and to get them to say, hey, this is what's happening. Britain, they're trying to get people to testify about the ways in which social media has been used in race riots, for example, and some of the, disrupt that you've seen in cities over the last couple of years. But we need to figure out how these platforms are being used to manipulate us, because it happens every day, every second.
Yeah, no, that's true. I'm more sort of reflecting, I suppose, on who's in charge politically across Europe. Yes, there is a threat from the far right, but mainly the centrist parties are still there, right, in Britain, France and so on. But is it maybe not government these people are looking at all? Maybe they, as you said, maybe they feel they can sort of sidestep central governments and just create their own private economy. That's really what their model is.
Yeah, that's 100% what they would like the model to be. And frankly, in the U.S. in particular, they're pretty close to having that. If you look at the amount of lobbying money each year that comes from various industries, big tech outstrips everybody. And you can actually look at particular bits of legislation that are up in Congress and see how they get squashed down by lobbying dollars from Silicon Valley. So, money talks, and these people have been able to trample over a lot of attempts to regulate and control them. And then I would actually argue, to your point about who's in charge politically, they've got a tremendous amount of power at the margins to swing votes and influence the attention economy, which is what matters.
Yeah, the information ecosystem, when they've got that controlled, everything else is kind of marginal, then, isn't it?
Indeed.
So, let's try and give our listeners something optimistic to reflect on.
Yeah.
We're probably, neither of us are probably doing a good job of that. But in terms of what might happen, or the fight back, or, the sort of reversal of this, obviously people still can go out and vote, but they, as you said, the information ecosystem is not necessarily stacked fairly. But people can push back against this. There is a pendulum swing usually in human affairs. So is there anything likely to happen? What are the threats from their point of view? What are the vulnerabilities in what they're doing? Is it they overreach? Mm. Is it their companies get overvalued and implode? Is it they all just get old and retire off somewhere? What's the thing that's going to potentially bring Musk, Thiel, etc., and sort of cut them down to size, if anything?
Yeah, or maybe they just go off to Mars, which, good riddance.
That's on the plan, right?
Yeah, that's on the plan. A couple of things are happening. In the U.S., you're actually beginning to see Republicans start to say, now, wait a minute, what's Elon Musk doing here? What's he cutting? Because if you look at where a lot of the stimulus money went in the last 4 years, it went into red states. And so as he's back, in the plumbing of government, nipping and cutting and snipping, suddenly Republicans in southern states, in Alabama and Tennessee, are saying, well, now, wait a minute. And they're having town halls. So there's a little bit of a pushback within the party, nascent, but it's happening. I think after the midterms in 2 years in America, you'll really see whether the proof is in the pudding, because a lot of people don't want to speak out too much, because Elon Musk might, what they call, primary them, meaning go into their primaries, their elections in 2 years, and just dump money on the opponents, which is, he did that in the presidential election. He dumped $200 billion in. That's a possibility. I think the other thing that, $200 million. The other thing that I think is a possibility is the coming together of the far, let's call it the far right in America, the MAGA crowd, and some of the far left, the sort of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders crowd, that are saying, well, now, wait a minute, these oligarchs, these money guys, these Wall Street and Silicon Valley guys are really still in charge. And the MAGA folks are actually very skeptical about this. Steve Bannon's of the world are sort of skeptical of Elon Musk and have really been speaking out against him. So we'll see how far that goes. And then I frankly hope that Trump's overreach will force Europe to get its act together and come together and really become the protector of liberal democracy. That is my great hope, and that could potentially, if it happens, be the huge silver lining of Donald Trump and Elon Musk.
So is the next piece we need to watch, obviously there'll be Trumpism throughout this whole calendar year and all sorts of things happening with Ukraine and so on. We've got a midterm election, if it's held as normal, etc., next year. Is that the next sort of taking stock moment, no pun intended, for what's going to happen, where the American public get a sort of a fresh chance to say whether they like all this stuff or not? Is that the one we should be watching?
Yes. 100%. Watch the midterms. If Congress turns in the midterms, America is okay, because you will then see the ability of Congress to regulate and rein in both Trump and people like Elon Musk. If Congress doesn't turn, watch out.
I'm already watching it, Rana. I don't need a second
well,
warning.
I'm glad I have a British passport. Let me just say that.
Well, you used to get your Irish one maybe as well, just indeed, in case indeed. Of have a backup, a backstop, yeah. As we used to say about Brexit. It might be a good idea.
Exactly.
Listen, we'll leave the conversation there. In some ways, it's a sobering one, but an important one nevertheless. Rana Fuhar, who is a columnist with the Financial Times, we really do appreciate you walking us through the politics and the ideology of what's going on at the moment. She is a columnist at the FT. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
Now, that's it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane. Yogo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening, and as ever, enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.